Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The thousands of people killed, injured, or displaced by the floods in Derna, Libya, were victims many times over of conflict and climate change, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres told world leaders gathered at the UN in New York on Tuesday. Derna was a sad snapshot of the state of our world, Mr. Guterres said at the UN General Assembly, as humanitarians in Libya continue to assess needs in the wake of the disaster. Here's one of them, UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, Assistant Chief of Mission in Libya, Rana Ksaifi, speaking to reporters from Benghazi.
The situation on the ground is catastrophic. I have been a humanitarian worker for over 19 years, and this is one of the worst disasters that I have witnessed. The level of destruction is unfathomable.
According to Ms. Ksaifi, an estimated 30,000 people have been displaced in Derna alone. Christopher Laker, the UN Development Programme UNDP resident representative in the country, said that 97% of some neighborhoods had been washed away as dams collapsed. He highlighted the urgent need for maintenance of Libya's water reservoirs and dams and said that UNDP teams would be supporting the authorities with infrastructure assessments. In Sudan, more than 1,200 children under 5 have died in camps in the space of 4 months from a combination of measles and malnutrition, UN humanitarians said on Tuesday. The children were refugees living in 9 camps in Sudan's White Nile state, according to UNHCR and the World Health Organization, WHO. The refugee agency said that over 3,100 suspected measles cases and more than 500 suspected cholera cases were reported in the same period in the country, along with outbreaks of dengue and malaria. Here's UNHCR's Chief of Public Health, Dr. Alan Maina.
The situation has brought the healthcare in the country to its knees, despite heroic efforts of local clinics and aid agencies to continue to provide much-needed health services.
WHO said that 3.4 million children in the country were acutely malnourished, while up to 80% of hospitals in conflict-affected states are out of action. With the lack of access to treatment, the UN Children's Fund UNICEF warned that many thousands of newborns may die in Sudan by the end of the year. Meanwhile, the UN's 2023 Sudan Humanitarian Response Plan, launched in May, remains only 30% funded. It is high time that countries make reparatory justice a priority to address the legacy of slavery and colonialism, which continues to negatively impact the daily lives of people of African descent across the globe. That's the message from UN Rights Chief Volker Turk, who called for strong leadership and political will from states to heed the call of people of African descent for accountability and redress for harms. His comments followed the release of a UN report which sets out a series of concrete steps for governments to make reparations from former colonists a reality. The proposed measures, which must be guided by people of African descent, include public apology, education and awareness raising, restitution and compensation. Up to 30 million people were violently uprooted from Africa for enslavement over the course of 4 centuries. After slavery ended, policies such as segregation and apartheid perpetuated racial discrimination. Mr. Turk stressed that reparatory justice was not just about addressing the wrongful acts of the past, but also about building societies that are truly inclusive, equal, and free from racism. Dominika Tomaszewska-Mortimer, UN News.
What are they going to say when the Chinese start plucking away American journalists, even though they've never been to China? They're claiming that Julian is under their jurisdiction because he published American secrets, even though he's not an American and he wasn't in America. And at the same time, while they claim jurisdiction over him, they're claiming he has no First Amendment rights because he's an Australian.
Craig Murray on the slow motion execution of Julian Assange on the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
That's right, and that'll be coming up in the second hour here at RF Radio Free Kansas. It's a beautiful day today. I spent the morning outside. We've got a whole week of it ahead. Very dry, very dry. However, it is beautiful temperature. Coming up is I did luck out and get this morning's Democracy Now!, so we're sort of fortunate about that. And today is Radio Eco Shock.
For radio as godless as our Constitution, tune in to Free Thought Radio. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. We are co-hosts of Free Thought Radio, radio for the rest of us, freethinkers, atheists, and agnostics.
Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
From the secular point of view.
That's coming up Friday. If you haven't listened to it, you'll enjoy it. I guarantee it. My voice is a little cracky. Sorry about that. Here's this morning's headlines from Democracy Now!
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Authorities in Nagorno-Karabakh say they've accepted a Russian-proposed ceasefire one day after Azerbaijan launched a military operation in the contested territory. Peace talks between Azerbaijan and Armenia are scheduled to start Thursday. Yesterday's attack reportedly killed close to 100 people and injured hundreds more. Tensions have been growing in Nagorno-Karabakh in recent months as Azerbaijani forces sealed off its only road linking it to Armenia, leading to major food, fuel, and medical shortages, as well as accusations of genocide. Nagorno-Karabakh is overwhelmingly populated by ethnic Armenians, but is recognized as Azerbaijani territory as part of a Russia-brokered ceasefire following the 2020 war. Protesters gathered in Armenia's capital, Yerevan, on Tuesday.
I hope that finally they can find any solution to this problem, solution that can satisfy both sides, and we can live peacefully. That's my opinion. I know it's difficult. It cannot be a decision which will satisfy both sides, but we should come to that. Otherwise, it will continue and hundreds, thousands of innocent people will die.
During the protests, police used stun grenades to disperse crowds trying to enter a government building. Israeli forces killed 19-year-old Palestinian Durran al-Ahras during a raid near Jericho in the occupied West Bank earlier today. His grieving father decried his killing.
He is an unarmed citizen, a child. He has nothing to do with all this. Durran is an unarmed person. He is a civilian. Whoever walks the street should be shot just because he is one of our people.
One day earlier, on Tuesday, Israeli soldiers killed another four Palestinians, including three in the occupied West Bank, in a raid on the Jenin refugee camp with 20 others injured. Separately in the Gaza Strip, 25-year-old Yusuf Salam Radwan was shot dead by Israeli soldiers. On Sunday, Israel said it's keeping the Beit Hanun crossing closed as it violently cracks down on Palestinian protests. Beit Hanun is the only operational crossing for Gazans to enter Israel, including some 18,000 Palestinians who work in Israel. This comes as President Biden's meeting Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly here in New York. The Biden administration's criticized the gutting of the judiciary by Netanyahu's far-right coalition government and its plans to expand illegal settlements, though it has not pulled back its $3.8 billion in annual military funding to Israel. The U.S. is also pushing a deal to fully normalize relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia. The New York Times reports the Biden administration's in talks with Saudi Arabia over a mutual defense treaty that would resemble military pacts the U.S. has with Japan and South Korea. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is reportedly also seeking U.S. help to develop a civilian nuclear program. While campaigning for president, Biden vowed to make MBS a pariah over the assassination of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi and other human rights issues. In related news, Houthi negotiators and Saudi officials wrapped up 5 days of talks in Riyadh on a possible path to ending the war in Yemen. The Saudi-led U.S.-backed conflict has killed hundreds of thousands of people since 2015, with 80% of Yemen's population relying on humanitarian aid. Here in New York, world leaders continue to address the UN General Assembly. The addresses began yesterday. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky warned Russia's invasion poses a threat to all nations.
And it is a clear Russia's attempt to weaponize the food shortage on the global market in exchange for recognition for some, if not all, of the captured territories. Russia is launching the food prices as weapons. The impact spans from the Atlantic coast of Africa to the Southeast Asia, and this is the threat scale.
President Biden expressed ongoing support for Ukraine and condemned Russia's naked aggression. In his speech, Biden also called for global climate action, global AI, artificial intelligence regulations, managing competition with China, and urged the UN to back a security support mission to Haiti, as he called it, where gang violence has been surging. One day after a high-profile Iran-U.S. prisoner swap, the Iranian president, Ibrahim Raisi, told the U.N. General Assembly the U.S., quote, project to Americanize the world has failed, as he hailed a new world order. He also called on the U.S. to revive the Iran nuclear deal President Trump pulled the U.S. out of.
America should demonstrate its goodwill and genuine willingness to fulfill its commitments and conclude the path.
Outside the UN headquarters, protesters gathered to condemn Iran's crackdown on dissent and protest just after the first anniversary of the killing of Mahsa Amini. Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel called for major reforms to international economic institutions and national debts that have overwhelmingly harmed countries in the global south. Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva also addressed the UN.
We will continue to criticize any attempt to divide the world into zones of influence and to reissue the Cold War. The UN Security Council is progressively losing its credibility. This fragility stems in particular from the actions of its permanent members who wage unauthorized wars in pursuit of territorial expansion or government change.
Lula's comments echoed calls for a change to the international order at this weekend's G77 summit as low- and middle-income countries met in Havana, Cuba. Among those addressing the G77 was Honduran President Xiomara Castro.
We are not pieces in a board that promotes dependency. Our nations must not keep on suffering the massive privatization of their territories.
In Washington, D.C., House Republicans remain mired in turmoil as infighting and threats by the far right push the government closer to an October 1st shutdown. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy delayed a key procedural vote Tuesday on a 30-day stopgap spending bill after opposition from members of the Freedom Caucus. Hours later, that hardline Freedom Caucus also blocked debate on a Pentagon spending bill and another blow to McCarthy. Meanwhile, House Democrats and some less extreme Republicans could work together to garner enough support for a spending bill that would bypass McCarthy and the far right's demand for massive spending cuts. In Pennsylvania, Democratic Governor Josh Shapiro announced Tuesday, Pennsylvania will now automatically register eligible voters when they obtain or renew driver's licenses or ID cards.
We'll save taxpayers time and money, reduce the number of costly paper registrations, and streamline voter registration for Pennsylvania. Look, this is common sense. You already provide proof of identity, residency, age, and citizenship at the DMV. All the information you need to register to vote.
Pennsylvania joins 23 mostly Democratic states in Washington, D.C., in having some form of automatic voter registration. Meanwhile, Democrat Lindsey Powell easily won a special election Tuesday in Pittsburgh, restoring the Democrats' one-seat majority in the Pennsylvania House. She's the first black woman to represent the predominantly white 21st district in Allegheny County. West Point's being sued over the military academy's race-based admissions policies. The lawsuit is spearheaded by the same anti-affirmative action group that sued Harvard and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The conservative Students for Fair Admissions won that landmark case before the U.S. Supreme Court in June, gutting race-conscious admissions policies at colleges and universities nationwide. But the ruling excluded military academies. And at least 20 indigenous leaders and climate activists were arrested Tuesday as actions demanding an end to fossil fuels continued during New York's Climate Week. Dozens of protesters swarmed the Bank of America Tower in Manhattan yesterday, blocking entrances as they chanted, "We need clean air, not another billionaire." The bank is one of the largest funders of oil, gas, and coal across the globe, as well as the leading financial backer of the contested Mountain Valley Pipeline. This is environmental activist John Beard of the Port Authority Community Action Network in Texas.
We refuse to be sacrificed any further on the altar of big oil, big gas, and big finance and BOA. We refuse to allow them to put profits over people and determine the lives and future of people in the Gulf South without them having any benefit from it and destroying the very planet upon which we all depend.
That's environmental activist John Beard of the Port Arthur Community Action Network in Texas. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
At the end of summer 2023, extreme rains struck different countries around the world. It's super shocking. Streets flooded, cars being pulled away, over 10,000 people died, and property damage is enormous. Is this the new stormy climate James Hansen warned about? We investigate with American extreme rain and flash flood expert, Dr. Jonathan Gourley from the NOAA National Severe Storms Laboratory. But Australian climate lecturer Andrew King cautions, not all floods are sure signs of global warming. Then my report about insidious smog killing millions of people every year. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. Without warning, flash floods wash cars away as roads become rivers. You can't miss those videos popping up all over the world. Spain, Las Vegas, Brazil, Hong Kong, Turkey, Shanghai, the Netherlands, Greece, and then parts of East Libya washed away, thousands dead. All this in just the first 2 weeks of September. A year's worth, and even 3 years' worth of rain falling in a day. What is happening? Is this a new twist on climate change? Searching for experts on extreme rain and flash floods, Jonathan Gourley comes in the top tier. With over 50 co-authored papers, Dr. Gourley is a research hydrologist at the NOAA National Severe Storms Laboratory in Oklahoma. Gourley is also adjunct associate professor at the University of Oklahoma School of Meteorology. From Norman, Oklahoma, Jonathan Gourley, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me.
I can't keep track of all the bizarre extreme rainfalls and flash floods this month alone. What do you think is going on?
Well, I think what you're seeing is the result of extreme heating that we've been experiencing, because if you look at the global temperatures, we've been setting monthly records. So if we look at the theory of that, then what happens with warmer oceans, then you add more fuel to these tropical storms and hurricanes. And then the part that I work on is more the inland flash flooding, and that's less impacted by the warmer oceans, but everything's connected in the Earth system, of course. And so what I study is more of the, let's say, the land surface impacts that we get from warming and what that results in terms of rainfall. So with increased temperatures, then what we have is much greater potential for heavy rainfall, since the atmosphere can hold much more water vapor in it, warmer temperatures, then it has the capability to transport that increased water vapor over land surfaces. And then what we get with that is the potential for much heavier rainfall. And that's what we've been seeing in the last couple months.
Well, still puzzling to me, why does a long drought so often end not with a gentle transition to wetter weather, but a breakout of hard rain and instant floods? Have you noticed that pattern, and what could explain that?
Yeah, sure. Well, what you're referring to is called these kind of whiplash events. And so it's been observed in maybe just the past couple of years. It's kind of a new line of research. And what you see is these, what we call pluvials, or these kind of rainfall periods where it's anomalously wet. So after we get these pluvial events when it's anomalously wet, then a lot of times you see these situations where it shuts off and becomes dry all of a sudden and remains that way. And many researchers have coined that term a flash drought, And so we're seeing that more frequently now in today's climate, which is projected to become more extreme as we move forward under the similar emissions if we continue in this way.
Let's take a simple example. Talk to us about what happened at a super popular camping spot, which turned out to be in a fire burn site in Colorado.
Yeah, so we've been looking at wildfire. You probably also noticed in the western part of North America, Canada in particular, in this summer, that we've also seen as a result of climate change much bigger, hotter, and more expansive wildfires. So the immediate impacts of that, of course, are threats to communities and homes and nature itself, and also the air quality of the folks that are downstream of that. But what is not as well known is what can occur for years, you know, up to 5 years after an area has been burned. We refer to that sometimes as a burn scar. And these areas have been denuded of their vegetation. And also, when the fire burns hot enough, then what it can do is it can make the soil become something we call hydrophobic, and that means it doesn't allow the water, the incoming rainfall, to infiltrate as readily as it does. So normally our soils and vegetation act as a buffer against heavy rainfall. There's some uptake by the vegetation, right? That's how it grows. And the soils also act as a buffer, so the water infiltrates and enables the incoming rainfall to not result in as much runoff as we would normally get. But when we start paving over surfaces, like in big expanding cities, and then also in a burn scar, you've essentially kind of done the same thing by having these hydrophobic soils and lack of vegetation. So you lost your buffer against the incoming rainfall. So in the particular burn scar that we're referring to there in southeastern Colorado, they had a very large, a mega fire, as it's called there. And there happen to be quite a few popular tourist locations that are downstream of the burn scar. And a lot of those folks are traveling from out of state, so they may be unaware that the area upstream of them has been burned, and they're in a vulnerable location, a lot of RV camps and things like that next to rivers. And so, yeah, that's the research that we've been conducting there, is to set up instrumentation on the burn scar and observe the rainfall and the extreme runoff that occurs there. So when I was there, we had events that can trigger what we call a flash flood or even a debris flow, where it picks up rocks and sediment and moves a lot of mud downstream. And that can be triggered by as little as an inch or about 25 millimeters of rain. So that's really not much when we think where I live down here in Oklahoma, it's not unusual to get 6 inches of rain. So just as little as 1 inch of a rain can create a really nasty problem that can block roads and even push debris through homes and communities. It's a problem, and it's one that we could foresee is getting worse as areas are getting burned.
So you could be out camping, there's no sign that there's been a fire there, you're maybe even in a forest, and then rather suddenly this can come up. How fast can the water appear?
Yeah, it depends on a number of factors, you know, how heavy was the rainfall, how intense really is probably a better way to state that, is, you know, that's what we see with these triggering events is intense rainfall that may only last an hour or even less than that. But it's a burst of rainfall that then falls on this burned area, and it quickly becomes runoff and moves downstream. So it depends on how extreme that rainfall rate is, but more importantly, how far downstream are you from that? So it can be 10 or 15 minutes. If you're actually on the burn scar, it's going to be just a few minutes. So it's really a short time for reacting. And so that's why we're trying to develop some early warning capabilities to detect these that are occurring and try to get the word out via SMS text and other means through the National Weather Service and local emergency management officials to then notify that something bad is about to happen downstream, and it could be as short as 15, 20 minutes.
Well, I'm going to ask you a lot more about that in just a couple of minutes. First, I want to get a couple of basic facts in. You have co-authored papers looking into flash flood fatalities in the United States. Are those deaths increasing, or are we handling them better?
Yeah, to look at the long-term trends of flash flood fatalities, it's a not extreme uptick in that amount. That's not an area that I've researched too heavily on those trends. But what we do find with those fatalities and circumstances surrounding the fatalities, that the vast majority of them are in what I would call a dynamic situation in terms of the vulnerability. And what I mean by that is it typically occurs when people are out and about. Rarely does a flash flood come to you and disturb you in your home. Tornadoes will do that. But flash floods become deadly whenever people are driving into them. That's what occurs about 60% of the time. And then the second leading cause is, again, people that are out and about. They're in a environment that's familiar to them, like in their neighborhood, and they may be out checking on a drain that's plugged up. Then they may clear the drain, and then they get into trouble, or even people that are recreating in floodwaters, which is a very hazardous thing to do. And then we find that the third most leading cause of flash flood fatalities are, again, people outside in an unfamiliar environment. So this would be people that are camping next to a river in a popular spot. Maybe they're hiking in a slot canyon. And so these are factors that get people into trouble. So there are ways that we can try to mitigate these. I mean, the natural hazard, without a doubt, is becoming worse. The question is that I'm faced with is how can we get out better, more focused, targeted information to people to let them know that this is a situation that's potentially hazardous, and turn around, don't drown, and potentially something we're working on is here's an alternate route you could take. You're about to enter an area that's potentially dangerous. Here's another route to go that you can take that would be a safer way to go. So these are ways that we can try to mitigate the fatalities with the understanding that the natural hazard itself is getting worse. So how can we mitigate that so that the fatalities don't increase along with the natural hazard increase?
These downpours are such short duration they can't possibly show up in climate models, but you made a career testing ways to predict imminent danger from flash floods. Why don't you start with the tools used on the ground to measure these events, like surface velocity radar? What's that all about?
Yeah, so there were multiple lines of defense for detecting flash floods and warning against them. First, I'll begin with the weather radar. That's going to be the ability to detect rain when it's still in the air. And we've really come a long way. That's an area that I began researching in the late 90s, was using weather radar to estimate rainfall at really high accuracy, fine resolution, you know, 1 square kilometer grid with updates every 2 to 5 minutes. So it's weather radar has really come a long way in the past 2 decades, to the point where we can use it very reliably as an input to a hydrologic modeling system. So that's the first line of defense, is detecting the heavy rainfall while it's still in the air. Then the time that you're afforded, so to speak, depends on how quickly the land surface responds. You know, in certain areas like burn scars, that can be 15 minutes up to hours, a few hours, somewhere in there. So the next thing that we do is we take that rainfall and we put it through what we call a hydrologic modeling system. So it takes the rainfall and physically models it infiltrating and interacting with the underlying vegetation and ultimately becoming runoff. So we use a digital elevation to kind of direct the surface water over the land surface and try to track that, the timing and the magnitude of where that's going to become a problem. We have some other observational tools that are more challenging for our model in situations like burn scars, where we don't model that as well. So that's still an active area of research. And because our models are not as cognizant of the underlying land surface conditions and how they respond, then another thing that we put out in the field, and in particular on burn scars, are these radars. Again, it's a radar, but in this case, it's pointing down at the stream. and it's actually two radars. So one of them is measuring the distance from the radar to the water surface, so it can detect when the water is increasing its height or its stage. And then the other really valuable piece of information that we've learned in this field experimentation is the use of a Doppler radar. And so this can detect the actual speed of the water as it's moving through the channels. And that one's a really, we find that one tends to be the most responsive in burn scar areas. So in other words, you don't see necessarily a big jump up in the water stage or the height of the water, maybe sometimes only, a couple feet or so. But it's the velocity that really increases in these situations. And that's because you have steeper terrain there, and then all of the land surface impacts that you've had from the fire, and that results in a fast moving water, and that can be really problematic in terms of activating sediment and moving it and transporting it downstream and creating these really muddy flows that a lot of times you see with flash floods and debris flows. So it's another line of defense that we can detect with these velocity radars. And another key aspect that we have with the data loggers in there is we can program certain alerts. So if the velocity goes over a threshold that we've set, and we actually set a couple thresholds, then we can program in cellular numbers for local authorities, and myself, I get them as well, and we'll be notified that says, hey, this gauge is detecting, 15 feet per second or something, whatever the threshold is, we've exceeded it, heads up. And so that's another nice feature with this, that it provides, maybe 10 to 15 minutes of some early alert that now you have kind of a boots on the ground kind of observation that something's really happening and it's potentially going to impact people downstream.
Well, this, Jonathan, it's a worldwide problem, and it seems unlikely the U.S. or any country could mount enough ground sensors or enough equipment near the ground to warn people of flood danger. So meteorologists are turning increasingly to satellite data. Can that help with flash flood prediction?
Yeah, satellite data offers the potential to monitor areas over much larger expanses, like the globe, for instance. The challenge with the satellite data is that, the satellites, by definition, are further away, and so the information content that they get is not quite as rich as what we would get with on-the-ground sensors, like from weather radar, and more importantly, it's the resolution of the data that we're getting. So, we'd be happy to get a pass, like once an hour or something like that. So we're dealing with hourly rainfall accumulations over a bigger grid cell, like, that may be 8 kilometers. So you can kind of get a broad idea where there's heavy rainfall occurring in an area, but it's not quite as targeted as what we would get with the weather radar.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith. Our guest from the National Severe Storms Lab is Dr. Jonathan Gourley. A paper published in March 2021 said this about the United Kingdom's prospects, quote, compared to a hypothetical natural climate, we estimate a tenfold increase in the chances of such extreme rainfall events in the United Kingdom by the end of this century, which underlines the need for effective adaptation planning. So this isn't just an American problem. Obviously, we see that in the news. Is your lab working with overseas scientists and other experts and other governments to kind of pool this technology and spread it around and do the best we can with it?
Yeah, sure. We really are in the meteorological and hydrological community. We're really a global community. So we get together at international conferences and work together on these things all the time. And in our laboratory in particular, we have relationships with agencies worldwide, where we work with a number of countries in the Far East and in Korea and South Korea and Taiwan and some in Europe as well. So we're very interested in sharing technologies and ideas and software in today's world with open source software, that there's a lot greater capability to share our models and compare them. And it helps them and it helps us out too, because we can do a lot of side-by-side comparisons of our models. We do this with the French as well, with the Météo France. And so it enables us as a community to have better, smarter, faster models that can hopefully tackle this problem and save lives worldwide.
Well, some scientists are suggesting that extreme rainfall events may become as important as extreme heat or rising seas when it comes to climate change. In an article, my friend Judy Deutsch writes, quote, on July 13, 2023, James Hansen wrote that the Earth is heading into a new frontier of global climate in which the moisture extremes are more important than the temperature extremes. Hansen writes, quote, higher absolute humidity and deeper penetration of moist convection causes a larger portion of the rainfall to occur in intense thunderstorms. What do you think, Jonathan?
Yeah, well, historically, the number one killer, weather-related killer, or meteorological killer, if you will, has been heat. So that's something that we can't ignore. And then coming in close behind that would be flooding and rainfall. Induced natural hazards, including landslides and debris flows and things of the nature. So of that nature, so it's a little difficult to foresee which one is going to win out in terms of, I guess you could call it winning out, but which one's going to dominate in terms of being a bigger killer worldwide. But we do see, and we know theoretically, just as he stated, that with warmer air temperatures, you get this more invigorated convection with heavier rainfall rates. And so it's going to end up finding more people inland in places that may not be accustomed to these heavy rainfall rates and floods. And that's an area that I've studied, is what we call the pluvial flash flooding or rainfall induced flash flooding. And that's where you don't necessarily get flooding in places you might expect it, like in floodplains and places where you have rivers that have overtopped the banks and flooded the nearby areas there. And those are a little bit easier to detect using our digital elevation models. But these are going to be more tied to the footprint of the rainfall itself. So again, if we have these new big, heavy footprints of rainfall in areas that haven't experienced it before, then they're going to become particularly vulnerable. And so that's going to be an area of, ongoing and future research, or to identify these areas that may not be accustomed to handling these heavy rainfall rates, and trying to build defenses and better warning systems to try to protect against that.
Well, I think heat may continue to cause more deaths, but floods and extreme rains do cause a lot of property damage. They're very, very expensive to the economy, as we all know. In June 2022, you co-authored a paper about U.S. floods, current status and forecast under a future warmer climate. Your team's predictions for a business as usual end of century, if we don't do anything, are somewhere between ominous and frightening, I think. Overall, flood frequency increases 100%. Covering 44% more area with, quote, more random and unpredictable events throughout the year. That sounds as bad as sea level almost. Why don't we hear more about this?
Well, that's a good question, Alex. I think this is the kind of information that we need to get out there. And yeah, that's what our study did, was to basically look at a future climate condition under business as usual emissions, and take that atmospheric perturbation, so to speak, and put it into a more contemporary climate simulation. And the reason why we do that is because a lot of times the climate models don't quite resolve the deep convection that's causing the flash flooding. And so with this other pseudo-global warming approach that we employed, we're able to resolve that convection. It's over a shorter time period, more like a decade, or 13 years to be more precise. But with this shorter time period, then what we can do is actually simulate that deep convection, and more importantly, how it changes because of these anomalous conditions that under a business as usual emission scenario. And that's what we see is a big uptick in the frequency, the time of the year. We're seeing more in these simulations, more flash floods that are occurring less in the warm season in North America, which would be our summer months, but we see them more in cool season months. So it's becoming more of a year-round kind of a threat. And also the intensity of these flash floods. So that's one of the variables that we looked at, was flow. How quickly does it arrive? Does a flood wave arrive? And what is the magnitude of that? And we find that increases about, depending on, which part of the country you're looking at, but around 8%, 10% in certain areas. So that's a pretty significant change in terms of higher magnitude and faster flash flooding that's going to occur. And that, of course, is going to be related to damages to property and, unfortunately, impacts on people, because there's simply less time to warn people for them to react. And also, it's just higher magnitude flooding. So higher velocity can knock people off their feet and cars and so on. So, it's going to become a bigger hazard unless we get it under control.
We know most cities have storm drains to take away the rain, and some were planned and built over a century ago, even longer if you're over in Europe. The EPA says extreme single-day precipitation events are increasing every decade, along with the greenhouse gases and heat. Has anyone tried to calculate the public cost of replacing whole city drainage systems to cope with extreme rains now and in the future?
I'm sure that's been done. The issue with handling, you know, or trying to model the function of a storm sewer system is that it's very city dependent, meaning that, you know, you may have one city that has a very aggressive plan and they've even mapped out all the details of their storm sewer infrastructure, and therefore we could potentially model it better and even give them scenarios. You know, if you invest X amount and you increase the capacity by this certain amount, then here's what the flooding would look like. But then on the flip side, you can go to certain cities and towns where all of this is stored on, you know, maybe a paper map somewhere in someone's desk. And so that becomes a little more challenging. So our goal is to try to model something on more of a continental basis that may have some nested domains that has higher resolution over cities. But it becomes challenging to do that when you have such differences amongst the cities in how they not only model it or prepare for it, but just simply how they map it and how that's stored digitally and if that can be incorporated in our modeling systems.
States with frequent tornadoes have decent warning systems. Sirens go off, telephones bleep warnings. The TV weather person says take shelter right now if you live in such and such a county. But how about flash floods? What would you like to see in the way of a public information system and then a warning system?
That's a great question. Right now, I would say that, let's say the people's perceptions of flash floods and their and more importantly, their actions to respond to them are woefully inadequate, especially compared to tornadoes. So there could be a number of changes that could improve that public response, one of which could be a more targeted warning system. And the National Weather Service in the U.S. and many other weather services have taken approaches to deal with this. And the one I'm most familiar with in the United States is what they call these impact-based warnings. So now the warnings are kind of categorized into three different levels, a base level, and then considerable and catastrophic. And so as you move up to the considerable and catastrophic, then they trigger higher levels of alerting. So if it goes to considerable, then you'll have the wireless emergency alert system will notify your cell phone, for instance, whereas a base level will not. So that's one step that we can take to kind of target and separate the more nuisance level flash floods to the ones that are really going to be problematic. Something else that we're working on is try to really refine the impacts themselves and try to forecast those. So right now we're doing a decent job of forecasting the natural hazard itself, saying, okay, we're going to have a really bad flash flood. But another question is to say, okay, which roads are going to be potentially impacted? And if we can forecast that with a reasonable amount of accuracy, then that provides really good detailed information that an emergency manager can use, for example. And if they have that information in time, then they can go out to these points that we're highlighting and set up flood defenses and block the roads and reroute drivers and do things of that nature. So I would say that's probably the best way to go after this, is to have more impact-based warnings of which roads are going to be inundated, which creeks are going to be overflowing and causing problems in certain neighborhoods, and really trying to pinpoint the targets a little bit better than right now is kind of a broad brush swath of an area that may be a whole city or even a county or something, but to really target specific neighborhoods and streets and creeks and homes that may be in trouble.
As we close this out, Jonathan, on a personal level, are you shocked by what you're seeing in the flash flood and extreme rainfall news around the world these days?
Yeah, I would have to say, after watching the news and social media reports and everything, that it really is shocking. It, in my opinion, that it's accelerated quicker than we anticipated on these impacts. And, you know, a yellow or even a red flag is when you see these global monthly temperatures that are setting records, and that's the fuel that's creating all of this. But it's occurring so quickly and with extreme impacts that, especially in the last year, has been a shock to see all of these impacts occurring more quickly than I personally would have anticipated. I thought we would see this kind of thing decades down the road, but it does appear, at least anecdotally, to be occurring more frequently now.
From the University of Oklahoma and the NOAA National Severe Storms Laboratory, we've been speaking with Dr. Jonathan Gourley. Find links to all the science and news we talked about in my show blog, Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Jonathan, thank you for sharing your expertise with our listeners. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for the opportunity. I appreciate it, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Streets turn to violent rivers, houses flood, even in desert areas. Social media is filled with apocalyptic scenes of extreme rainfall this year. In the first week of September, Hong Kong recorded its heaviest hourly rainfall on record, with 158 millimeters, that's 6.2 inches, between 11 p.m. and midnight. Epic rains fell in Spain, Greece, Turkey, Bulgaria, Brazil, and oh yes, Burning Man. But is it all due to global warming? Andrew King is senior lecturer in climate science at the University of Melbourne. He says climate change isn't always to blame for extreme rainfall. Andrew led a new paper in Nature Geoscience to explore what is and is not happening here. From Melbourne, Australia, Andrew King, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me on, Alex.
Why did you and your Australian colleagues investigate the drivers of extreme rains and floods and how we talk about them?
Well, it's important for us to understand the role of climate change in different types of extreme weather events. There's a tendency these days for us to kind of automatically link any kind of extreme weather to climate change. But we know, of course, that before we were influencing the atmosphere through our greenhouse gas emissions, we were already seeing extreme weather events. It's not always climate change that's to blame. For heat extremes, we have a really clear trend. We know that human-caused climate change is exacerbating heat waves across the world, both on land and in the ocean. But for extreme rain events, it's a much more complicated link.
Talk to us about the nasty floods in eastern Australia in 2022. What happened there?
So we saw really heavy rainfall and bad flooding actually repeatedly over the last few years in Australia. Ever since kind of late 2020, we've had generally quite wet conditions across Australia, not so much the last few months, but we had 2 to 3 years where it was consistently quite wet. And we had some really very wet spells, including in early 2022, when we had really exceptional rainfall and lots of records broken along the east coast of Australia, so really around Sydney and Brisbane particularly. So we saw very heavy rainfall over several days and very severe flooding that did result in fatalities and lots of infrastructure damage, very high insurance costs. And this was not long before a federal election in Australia. So there was great interest in this event and the government's response to this event, but also the government's action on climate change.
And did you end up concluding that that flooding was due mainly to climate change or due to other causes?
So with this event, we determined it's most likely due to other causes, really. We had a La Nina at the same time, and during La Nina events. So La Nina is when we have colder than normal ocean conditions in the central and eastern Pacific and warmer than normal conditions in the West Pacific. And because the warmer than normal sea temperatures are nearer Australia, that means there's kind of the conditions for rainfall to occur more easily in eastern Australia. So there's more moisture in the air and more frequent low pressure systems. We typically see wetter than normal conditions during La Niñas in Australia, and we think that that was the main driver. But also we had quite a bit of bad luck, I think. We had weather systems that kind of stalled over eastern Australia and basically caused persistent rain for several days. And we don't think that climate change is really... Well, we don't fully understand the climate change effect on those weather system patterns. Climate change probably played a small role in the event, but it wasn't a primary driver by any means.
Well, that's interesting, because for years we've been given the maxim that for every degree of warming, the atmosphere can hold about 7% more moisture, and that's a huge amount of water transferred from the ocean or the land or the ice fields up into the sky. How can that extra load of airborne water not be a factor in pretty well every extreme rain event?
So we have different types of extreme rain events. We have extreme rain that occurs over an hour or two that causes flash flooding, and we have extreme rain events that last many hours or days and tends to cause river flooding. So the kind of more persistent heavy rain causes longer term or larger scale floods. And certainly the effect of warming the atmosphere and it being able to hold more moisture is really important. We know that this is the case, and we can observe, especially for short duration extreme rain events, that this is a really important effect in intensifying those kind of torrential downpours. So when we have, over most of the planet, we see intensification of extreme rain events on timescales of minutes and hours. But for extreme rainfall that occurs over several days, the biggest factor is having weather systems in place for a very long time that deliver extreme rainfall. The other part of the ingredient for extreme rainfall beyond the moisture is having low pressure, having rising air that has to condense and precipitate out rainfall. And we don't really fully understand the climate change effect on these weather systems. We think it's regionally variable. So in some parts of the world, we think climate change is intensifying these low pressure systems and making them more frequent. But in eastern Australia, if anything, we might think that they're slightly decreasing in occurrence. So that means we might have kind of two contrasting effects, where climate change is increasing the amount of moisture available to be precipitated out, but might be decreasing kind of the propensity of the air to actually rise and cause extreme rain in some parts of the world. And this is really important for these kind of longer duration extreme rain events like we saw in eastern Australia last year.
Well, this reminds me too of storms like Hurricane Harvey in 2017. It just sort of sat over Texas and rained for days. And we can contrast that with a recent event here in North America. Hurricane Idalia roared over Florida in the southeast, and there were big storm surges, there were heavy winds, but there wasn't a lot of flooding, and I think that's because it moves so fast compared to storms like Harvey. So are we talking about the ability to rain, but then we're also talking about the speed of the weather system that's involved?
Absolutely. Yeah, but when weather systems move on very quickly, we tend to see shorter-term floods and maybe not as bad flooding. But when we have weather systems that stall over a region, you can get really bad flooding. And indeed, that is what happened with Hurricane Harvey. With the Hurricane Harvey event, which saw really bad flooding over Houston in Texas, we do think that climate change exacerbated that event. So there have been studies that have explored this event, and it does look like climate change increased the amount of precipitation from Hurricane Harvey. But in other cases, it's less clear, especially for the kind of mid-latitude low-pressure systems that affect regions a bit further away from the equator. and their persistence is kind of a bit harder to see a climate change signal in many areas.
Andrew, can you talk to us about one of your new 2023 papers, Climate Change Emergence Over People's Lifetimes? It sounds intriguing. What's it about?
So that paper is quite different from looking at extreme rainfall. This was about looking at warming that has occurred over people's lifetimes across the planet. So we can look at, well, kind of how perceptible warming has been over different parts of the world for different people. And generally, the longer someone has been alive, the more likely they are to have seen a clear signal of climate change, of local warming over their lifetimes. So generally, we see that the clearest warming occurs over equatorial regions for a given period of time. So if we look at, say, the last 50 years or the last 100 years, and we look at how clear is the local warming trend relative to just the variability in the climate, we see a really clear warming trend over tropical regions. But if we actually look at people's life experiences, because it tends to be that people in mid to high latitude areas are a bit older, so these are regions of the global north particularly. That's in contrast to in equatorial regions, which are typically in the global south, and we see much younger population demographics. The actual perceptibility of warming is roughly even between these different populations because it's a younger population in tropical regions and an older population in mid to high latitude regions, typically.
That's kind of strange in a way. I mean, you would think that older people would really realize the climate has changed, but I don't see a lot of climate acceptance in North America, for example. It's hard to say, but then you take a country like Iran or any in the Middle East where more than half the population are below the age of 25. They're really young, so they haven't experienced perhaps as much, but then again, it's been record hot in Iran. I guess they do know something's happening. It's very confusing how we would apply this on a social level and understand who does and doesn't understand climate change.
Indeed. Yeah, this is something I'm interested in, but I'm not a social scientist at all and probably need to work with a social scientist on this. I mean, we know that younger people generally are more concerned about climate change, and it might be more to do with education rather than experience. So older people, you know, during their schooling were less likely to hear about climate change because it was less of a problem, you know, a few decades ago, whereas younger people tend to be more aware of the problem of climate change. I think that might be kind of overriding this general issue of different experiences of climate change.
That makes sense. You know, you can have disasters in Australia, and Americans, Canadians, we don't hear very much about it. I long for media to become truly global because I don't see how we can tackle issues like climate until the public feels we are all part of one planet. Your thoughts about that?
I completely agree. And I would say, I would kind of go a bit further than that and say that we really don't hear much about extreme weather events in the global south. Typically, at least in Australia, we're more likely to hear about extreme weather events in North America or Europe than we are to hear about the ones that affect parts of Africa or South or East Asia. And we know in general that the impacts of extreme weather events are very different in different parts of the world. When we have a hurricane affecting the US, we typically don't see that many fatalities, but we see really large economic costs. When we have a tropical cyclone affecting a less developed region of the world, there's much more fatalities usually, many more fatalities, and lower economic damage. So I find it quite alarming how little we hear about extreme weather events that can kill hundreds of people in the global south. You know, they have huge impacts, and this is on regions of the world which are less resilient to extreme weather, less able to adapt and, you know, respond to extreme weather events. Yeah, the impacts are really much worse overall in these regions, but we don't hear about them.
Although that can change somewhat. I notice India's record on dealing with extreme weather events. They have really reduced the death rates, and Bangladesh has been doing not too bad too. But in general, I totally hear what you're saying. We're going to have to wrap this up. Is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
Mainly that we're in the middle of a bit of a crisis in that we have record high greenhouse gas emissions globally. So we're warming the planet at a record high rate. And even though there's all this talk about reaching net zero emissions and decarbonizing, greening our economy and society, we're a long way from doing that yet. We need to rapidly turn this around if we're going to tackle, really kind of limit global warming and reduce the impacts of climate change generally. So the next 2 or 3 decades are really, really critical, and we need to see really rapid changes.
From the University of Melbourne, we've been speaking with Dr. Andrew King, Senior Lecturer in Climate Science. You can find links to the news and science we talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Andrew, thank you for sharing your time with us.
No worries. Thanks for having me on.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Perhaps you were not listening to Radio EcoShock in early 2006. I'm going to replay my quick report on killer smog. It is just as true today. This will also prepare you for an upcoming program asking the question, if we clean it up, will that add to more warming and triggering tipping points? Is it too late for clean air?
A report from Radio EcoShock.
I think you're all aware that asthma rates in children have increased dramatically in recent years. There's been a reported doubling in incidence rates in the last 20 years. And a recent study confirmed that 25% of elementary school children in Harlem had asthma. And developmental problems have also been increasing, even accounting for improved diagnosis. Rates of learning disabilities, ADHD, and autism have increased, and an estimated 15% of elementary or school children in the U.S. have at least one learning disability.
That's right. Classrooms full of wheezing kids with inhalers in their pockets. Postmodern kids have damaged DNA and diminished IQ because chemicals are hitting them right in the womb in their earliest stages of development. Okay, this is last year's news, but the horror of industrial damage to our new generation of humans hasn't really reached us. We definitely don't want to hear that our air, seeming so clear, is poisonous. And our vehicles, those magic things that let us fly across the ground, reach right into the womb and our lungs ever after. A team of researchers led by Dr. Frederica Pereira has proven this with a groundbreaking study in New York City. The team from Columbia University followed hundreds of mothers from the first discovery of pregnancy through infancy and early childhood. One of the most important discoveries? Pesticides and other industrial chemicals are mixing with car exhaust, a kind of unseen toxic smog that penetrates the womb and harms humans at every stage of life. Pesticides cause birth defects, damage DNA, and predispose children to diseases later in life, especially cancer. We know this by science and by the sick and dying people exposed to pesticides. Of course, you don't use pesticides, just Mother Nature brand soap in your home, so you're okay, right? Not really. As Dr. Pereira describes in a 40-minute speech given to congressional staffers, pesticides are everywhere. Blood tests of random citizens, whether in Europe or North America, reveal 60 or more toxic chemicals running around in all of us. Trust me, you're getting your fair share of the chemical feast.
I've got mercury, lead, arsenic. I've got flame retardants. I've got the stain repellent. I've got PCBs. I've got pesticides. I've got insecticides. So, you know, digesting that and then thinking, well, these are carcinogens, these are toxins that are in me, and then thinking that we only tested for 88. So I have to just extrapolate that and think there are hundreds more in me, and there are hundreds more in everybody. You burst the bubble of denial pretty quickly.
The biggest non-surprise? Automobile smog combined with pesticides and stress form a super threat to human health. The exhaust of cars and trucks, which we all take for granted, is so powerful it crosses nature's protective barrier in the womb, the placenta, and injures our babies. The number of cars and trucks has more than doubled since the 1950s. We are producing a new damaged generation, the exhausted ones. Let's introduce Dr. Frederica Pereira from the Mailman School of Public Health, Columbia University. A stylish-looking woman, Dr. Pereira, known as Ricky to her friends, has that rare combination of vision and science and the skills to attract public agencies and dollars for the study of disadvantaged people. She argues it is far cheaper, not to mention more humane, to prevent diseases from the moment of conception than to pay for many lives of illness and disability. Exposure to pollutants caused chiefly by vehicles was measured by backpack air monitors worn by the women during the third trimester of pregnancy. When the babies were born, genetic alterations were measured. Researchers found an increase of about 50% in the level of persistent genetic abnormalities among infants with high levels of exposure, said the study's senior author, Dr. Frederica P. Pereira, director of the Columbia Center for Children's Environmental Health. Quote, "We already knew that air pollutants significantly reduced fetal growth, but this is the first time we've seen evidence that they can change chromosomes in utero," Dr. Pereira said, adding that the kind of genetic changes that occurred had been linked in other studies to increased risk of cancer. Well, those three paragraphs in the New York Times note that vehicle exhaust is altering the genes of newborns and a whole generation, and not in a good way. It's a shame that car pollution stories don't warrant the full-page spreads available to car makers and oil company advertisers. But Dr. Pereira said much more in a talk titled Prenatal Exposures to Pollutants and Future Health Risks. It was part of a policymaker education course for congressional staff, organized by the Harvard Medical School Center for Health and the Global Environment. It was on March 30, 2005. 25% of inner-city kids with asthma? Autism and other birth defects spiraling. 15% of school kids with a learning disability. In the 1950s, when cars were just beginning, these things were rare. Now they're common and growing. Everyone and every teacher knows a family with a child with difficulties. These problems are worst for visible minorities who enjoy the dense traffic and truck or bus yards built into their already burdened neighborhoods. But who doesn't live near a highway now? Who doesn't inhabit an airshed loaded with vehicle exhaust? In a criminal oversimplification of the doctor's speech, she emphasizes three major causes of genetic deformation and disease in the womb and childhood. Pesticides, vehicle exhaust, and stress stand out from a complex weave of possible causes, once obvious things like tobacco, alcohol abuse, and heavy metals like lead are factored out. The study found that stress of living in pollution feeds the terrible stress of trying to raise sick or mentally challenged kids. It's a negative feedback loop. Cars and trucks produce many chemical combinations, but gasoline and oil are basically hydrocarbons. When they are burned, they emit particles called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. That chemical name is too long, so we use the acronym PAHs. PAHs can occur in nature when organic matter burns, perhaps in a forest fire, but that's nothing like the persistent flood of airborne PAHs produced by our transportation system. There are many types of PAHs, and some of them are highly carcinogenic, cancer-causing, and mutagenic, creating mutations of DNA even in the womb. PAHs are found in all sorts of petrochemicals like solvents and dyes, as well as burnt gasoline. Roofing tar, creosote, and coal-fired power plants are strong sources of PAHs. So are cigarettes. But today, we're just focusing on vehicle exhaust.
For the PAHs, they are known carcinogens, developmental toxicants, and I'm referring to in experimental animals and or humans. And now there's beginning to be evidence that they also contribute to the causation of asthma. That is, prenatal exposures can contribute.
Breaking more new ground, this New York study tested the combination of chemicals in the real world as opposed to the standard government tests of individual chemicals by themselves.
We were quite ambitious in this research, and we're attempting to document exposures to all of these and to look at the effects of each one singly and then also in combination, because the real world, of course, is that you get exposed to all of these things. And previous studies have looked at one particular exposure at a time.
This is vital. Governments and chemical makers carefully isolate one chemical and test it on rats. They base the safety level, the amount you may be receiving, on this illusory system. In reality, all sorts of chemicals appear in untested combinations. We inhale and ingest a chemical smorgasbord that has never been tested on humans by anybody. We're all part of this global experiment to see what happens to human biology. Welcome to the experiment. Babies and kids are far more sensitive to environmental toxins than adults. The doctor explains why.
Now back to the this key issue that I can't hammer home enough. It is this heightened susceptibility in the developing fetus and young child. For many pollutants, at these life stages, the individual has differentially higher exposure. For the fetus, there's greater absorption and retention of certain toxicants, and that's true for the child as well. For the young child who is eating a great deal more food, ingesting a lot more food and water on a body weight basis than an adult, any pollutants in the food and water will also be ingested by that developing child. And then, of course, mouthing objects, crawling, that's another vector for exposure in the young child. So there's greater exposure, absorption, retention, but also the systems that we have operating we adults have operating at varying efficiencies, but much better than in the fetus and child, to detoxify chemicals and repair the damage they do to DNA are immature and not efficient in this early developmental period. And then the higher rate of cell proliferation puts cells, DNA, genes at risk and offers the potential for disruption in normal differentiation and growth. And then, of course, for carcinogens, there's just a lot more time for cancer to develop if the cancer is initiated as early as in utero. So there is concern about this window of exposure and susceptibility, and imagine what the preventive benefits could be if we could really take steps to protect this very sensitive period.
So in the Bronx and in Harlem, the team set up indoor air quality monitors and occasionally fitted the pregnant mothers with backpacks that measured pollution. That was all combined with blood tests, questionnaires, and a host of other measurement techniques. They followed up with health checks on the babies and followed the kids up to school age so far, all the while comparing the amount of pollution with the actual health of the children, both mental and physical. Science is proving that exposure to pollution sets up prenatal changes that can determine major diseases in childhood or even much later in life. The study doesn't just measure what toxins remain in the body. It shows the genetic damage caused by pollution.
This is a marker of genetic damage from, say, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, where the chemical has actually hit the DNA and latched onto it, and you can measure those fingerprints.
Chromosomes are damaged, immune systems compromised from birth by pollution. It's visible at a microscopic level, not a theory, but a provable fact. They studied the lives of 700 mothers. They found PAHs and pesticides in every air sample, in every breath they took.
And what we have found so far, I mean, I'm just going to give you a few highlights. The fetus is exposed to multiple toxicants. Air monitoring and questionnaire indicate that every single air sample taken during pregnancy, therefore every mother and every fetus, had prenatal exposure to PAHs and pesticides in air. And the levels did vary, and they appear to vary as a function of proximity of residents to major roadways, heavily trafficked roadways.
The fingerprints of DNA damage from PAHs was found in 40% of newborn babies. Organophosphate pesticides like diazinon were found in 100% of the babies. Doesn't the placenta, the blood barrier in the mother's womb, protect the unborn child?
Does the placenta provide any kind of barrier to chemicals?
Yes, it does. The placenta is intended to do that, and it does do that. It reduces, it's been estimated from experimental studies that it reduces the level of P PAHs, for example, by a factor of 10. And yet, I'll show you some findings that we have that suggest that even despite that protection, the fetus being more sensitive, less able to detoxify and repair damage, actually has as much or more DNA damage than the mother.
These pollutants also reduce birth weight, meaning more chance of illness or even reduced IQ in later life. Again, PAHs from auto exhaust and other carbon burners is now proven to reduce the survival of human offspring. New York City spends $450 million a year for their early intervention programs, trying to help the victims of pollution. The cost of treating asthma in American children in 2002 was $7 billion. Of course, many of the growing number of children with asthma in China or Poland don't get treatment at all. Add more billions of dollars for the productivity loss resulting from a drop in IQ, a generation less smart, less able to solve the problems that polluted their young bloodstreams. These are powerful economic arguments to reduce urban pollution.
Until all of a sudden, you feel like someone's choking you or an elephant sitting on your chest.
This report is from Radio EcoShock at www.ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.